This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz is here to talk about the science behind the Iran nuclear negotiations. And with the upcoming holiday weekend, you can be the culinary hero. Our cooking geek, Jeff Potter, has gone through dozens of eggs, chicken, emu, ostrich, to crack the secret to easy-to-peel hard-boiled eggs. So get excited, people! There are more egg puns in store, unfortunately. But first, let's play Good Thing, Bad Thing. This week, the U.S. pledged to the U.N. to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The target, 26 to 28% below 2005 levels over the next 10 years. And if things are going really well, a concerted push for that upper limit, a 28% cut in emissions, which the Obama administration calls, quote, a fair and ambitious goal. But is it fair and ambitious enough, or is it just business as usual? What's good about the pledge and what's bad? Here to play Good Thing, Bad Thing is Eric Holthaus. He's a meteorologist who writes about weather and climate for Slate magazine. Welcome to Science Friday, Eric.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good thing?
Okay, so the good thing is that we have a plan. This is the first time, you know, U.S. has been going to these international U.N. climate meetings since the 90s, and this is the first time we've ever committed, even though there's a voluntary pledge, the first time that we've had, you know, a target on the books with the U.N. that we're going to work towards. So the Obama administration believed that this is easily achievable, and it doesn't require any new legislation in Congress, which is good because we've been, you know, going back and forth about climate. Climate is a very deeply political thing still in the United States. So there's concern that the pledge may not have been possible, but the Obama administration thinks it is.
And bad thing.
Okay, so the bad thing is that we definitely could have done more. There's a number of independent analysts, climate scientists and policy experts that there's one in particular, the Climate Action Tracker, that rated the U.S. pledge as a medium ambition. So it's not quite enough to reach that 2°C goal that the world has set out to limit warming to. So the Union of Concerned Scientists this week pointed out that 29 states plus the D.C. already have a renewable energy standard in place, and there's a lot of, you know, kind of political horse trading that could happen if the Obama administration wants to work with Republicans. But, you know, as everyone knows, the Republicans have been kind of not on the progressive side of this, and the Obama administration has kind of tried to work around that by focusing on regulations and executive action. So a little bit more bipartisanship might help us cut carbon emissions a little bit more.
All right, Eric, we'll be watching this. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Yeah, thanks.
Eric Holthaus is a meteorologist who writes about weather and climate for Slate magazine. Next up, our weekly science roundup with Arielle Durham-Ross, a science reporter at The Verge here in New York. Welcome back, Arielle.
Hi.
All right. Hit me with your first selection.
Right. Well, the first thing I have for you is a study that was published in Nature this week. And in the study, researchers were able to make an exoskeleton that makes human walking easier. It improves it. It makes it more efficient, which means that you spend less energy when you walk around, and they improve the efficiency of walking by 7%.
Wow. So this is something you wear, or how does it work?
Yeah. So the way it works is that it's essentially like a leg brace that you slip into your shoe.
Yeah.
You wear it on both legs. What's very different about this, because people have made exoskeletons before that have been able to have similar levels of reduction, is that it doesn't have a motor. It doesn't use batteries. The way it works, it's just a system of a clutch and a spring that acts similarly to the way that your calf muscle and your Achilles tendon work together when you're walking around.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Is that available yet? Can you buy it anywhere?
It's not available yet. The researchers told me that it will cost a little less than $1,000. once they do end up, you know, if they do end up marketing it. Right now, it's kind of limited. It makes walking easier when you're walking around, but you can't run with it. It actually breaks. So they need to develop something. They hope to develop something that will be used for different situations. And they plan to initially market it to hikers and maybe even military personnel. That's their initial plan. The reason for that, they're actually more interested in medical applications, helping people with who have suffered a stroke or something of that nature. But there are so many regulations around medical products and medical devices. So they're going to start with that first.
Okay, that was a good one. Now, I have one to match you.
And okay.
It's a recipe from the Middle Ages from the 9th century. Now listen to this. This effectively kills antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and it's an ancient brew as effective as vancomycin, one of the last resort antibiotics today. And the recipe came from an old medical textbook called Bald's Leech Book. Pencils ready. Here's the recipe. You take garlic, onions, red wine, copper, and something everybody has on hand at home, cow bile, of course.
Oh, how nice.
Yes. You mix it, and you let it age for 9 days and nights, and the stuff actually works.
A lot of us think of these kind of physicians from back then as quacks and that didn't really know what they were doing.
That's Steve Diggle from University of Nottingham.
What's interesting about this is that it seems to have been a carefully put together recipe to treat a specific type of infection, and it actually worked against the organism it was likely to have been used against.
Wow, it's hard to believe. Then again, in this little recipe book, there are a lot of little potions, but not every recipe in the book sounds...
Some of them weren't that great.
Yeah, like this one.
There's things like, you know, that they tell you that you have to inhale something and chant for, like, 5 minutes. And like, you've also got a few recipes involving cow dung. Oh, there's a cure for baldness as well, apparently, that involves crushing up bees. So, and I could do with that one.
Well, you have me until the crushed bees on that one. Your turn. What's your next pick?
Well, there was another Ebola vaccine trial was published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine. This latest trial, it was a phase one trial. It was done on healthy people, about 150 healthy people all over the world. People who aren't at risk for Ebola. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be pretty effective in the sense that people who had it produced, you know, a lot of antibodies that could help them protect themselves against Ebola. But until it's tested in an area where people are actually at risk, it's hard to tell if it actually works. There is a trial underway right now, mm-hmm. included that has 27,000 people. It's taking place in Liberia, but we don't have the results yet, so we don't know if that vaccine will be efficient. They're also trying out a different vaccine as well. So it's kind of a waiting game, but right. Things are happening.
But in its initial one, it looked pretty effective, right, when they tried it out?
Yeah, it looks pretty effective. There are some side effects. Yeah. I think 22% of people had a fever after they had it, and then 35% had, or 19%. Mm-hmm. Had you know, arthritis for like 8 days after, had some pain in their joints. Yeah. But overall, it seems to be pretty well tolerated. There are two vaccines going on right now. One is based on a chimpanzee virus, and the other one is based on a cow virus. And they both seem promising.
Mm-hmm. What? Give me another quickie little
story. There was a study about babies and how they learn, published in the journal Science yesterday. And essentially what it shows is that babies spend more time looking at objects when they're surprised at the way they're interacting with the world around them. This builds on previous research that showed that babies have kind of a core knowledge about the world. They have depth perception. They understand how certain things work in terms of physics. This is probably adaptive. This is something that, you know, is evolutionary beneficial to them to have right off the bat as, you know, when they enter the world.
So they can be surprised by things because they have a preconceived from
right. And apparently they spend more time. So what the researchers did is that they did things like had an object seemingly float, you know, lots of sleight of hand, or they had an object that looked as though a ball that looked as though it passed through a wall. And when that happened, the baby spent a lot more time examining these objects, and they would also learn things about these objects more easily. So if that ball also made a sound, they would remember that ball made a sound. But if they weren't shown something surprising, then they wouldn't remember that the ball made a sound as easily. This doesn't necessarily mean that kids learn better when you surprise them. We don't really know that yet. It just shows that babies are you know, testing out their universe all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you have a quirky story to share with us.
Right. Some researchers, this is an environmental study, but it's interesting because they use tampons. So in England, old houses tend to have a double drain system. Pipes, you know, you'll have either wastewater will go through one drain system and then surface water will go through another. Those are newer houses. And that usually what happens is that, one, the surface water will end up not being treated. They'll go directly into the river. And you know, they save money that way. They don't have to treat all the water. Fortunately, sometimes the pipes aren't very well connected. So you end up having wastewater that goes into the rivers.
We don't like that.
No. So what the researchers found out is that tampons are actually really good at absorbing an optical brightener, which is what's used to whiten clothes and detergents. It's in toothpaste. Mm. And they absorb that really well. So if you use unused tampons and you soak them in optical brightener, they can actually become glow-in-the-dark under UV light for 30 days after you've soaked them in optical brightener. So they've been able to use that to trace back where the pipes aren't well connected simply by, you know, implanting these tampons in manholes and then trying to find out where, you know, what happened and where those tampons came from.
You know, this could be why use them only in sewers? You could have these parties.
Right. I mean,
why don't
presumably,
those glow sticks that you break? You
oh,
know,
yeah.
You could do
it's
this
a really cheap glow stick. That's actually one of the benefits of it, is that it's a very cheap way to find out where the pipes aren't well connected.
All right. Thank you. That was fascinating. Good way to follow up. Thank you, Ariel. Ariel Dunham-Russ, a science reporter on The Verge here in New York. We'll have you back.
Oh,
next time,
absolutely.
With some more wonderful little selected short subjects in science. Thanks for being with us today. We'll be right back. We're going to be taking a break, and then we're going to talk with Ernest Moniz, Energy Secretary of the United States, talking about the framework deal that was worked out with Iran announced yesterday. What is the science? He was in the seat for those negotiations. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the science in the news, waiting for Secretary Eric Moniz to show up, the Energy Secretary of the United States. He was involved with the negotiations with Iran on creating this framework for an agreement, and the scientists were very much involved. So I asked Ariel Dunham-Ross to stay with us a little longer.
Oh, thank you.
Because I want to go back to the story about the tampons. And you know, it was interesting that you bring this up, because years ago, I had a discussion with another sewage system engineer. Now, dirty little secret, so to speak.
Okay.
I really am interested in wastewater treatment. I almost went into it.
I didn't know that.
Yes, in college. And I really enjoy it. And I had a discussion with a professional sewage treatment engineer. And he said very much something similar to what you were saying about the tampons.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, in sewage plants around the world, when it rains, and he's talking about the United States also, he says it's a bad thing when you have an overflow from the sewage treatment, from the sewers into the systems that go into the water.
Right,
you don't
right.
want your sanitary system to mix with your rainwater system.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that happens so often, and that's a signal that we have to shut down the beaches because it's not good to swim, you know, where
right.
the water's
you don't
going.
Want to swim in that.
But he said there was one universal way. You don't need tampons. One universal way of figuring that out. I said, what was that? He says, Splenda. I said, the sweetener?
Uh-huh.
He says, yeah, your body doesn't do anything to it. Literally, you taste it, and it passes right through your body.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's untouched in its original form. When we find Splenda in the ocean or the rivers or whatever.
So they had a test to detect it.
Yeah, all you had to do was find that Splenda was in this, was, you know, in the streams or the sound or whatever. And you knew that it had leaked over from the sewage system into the rainwater system.
I personally prefer the visual of the glow in the dark, you know, tampons. I feel like that's very evocative.
I think of the creativity that someone sat
right.
down.
Right, and you know, people don't always want to talk about, you know, those hygiene products, but I think it maybe it'll, you know, elevate them a little bit.
Yeah, you know, finding different ways, different things for common household items.
Exactly.
Things that you can do with them. You see a lot of science stories as mm-hmm. a science reporter at The Verge. You must see dozens every week, like we.
Yeah, do. Yeah, I see a lot go by. I mean, there was the interesting, the news about the drought in California, mm-hmm. and how the governor essentially is asking for restrictions.
That's right. For the first time. Use. Yeah.
Right. That's the first time in the state's history. And you know, they've been going through this really terrible drought for a very long time. And when the governor announced that, Jerry Brown, he was standing on grass, on very, very dry grass where there's supposed to be snowpack. It's been very warm. Mm-hmm. This is an ongoing drought crisis. So they're finally going to impose some restrictions on the way that people use water. So the people who are supplying water to different municipalities will have to try to cut back and will have to report how much water is being used. They're trying to cut back by 25%.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Yeah. And then also golf courses, campuses will have to be a little bit more careful. Honestly, it's very interesting to me that golf courses are, still operating in a way. I mean, of course, I understand it's a business, but I'm interested to see how that's going. Yeah.
Yeah. Back in the day, it's hard to believe that with the winters and the rain that we've had here in the New York area in the East, mm-hmm. we had droughts back years and years ago.
Okay.
We had water restrictions. Some of the things you hear that California is being asked to do, like waiters will not serve you water in the restaurant unless you ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we had to do that here in New York a while back.
Oh,
I remember when they restricted water to washing cars. We restricted mm-hmm. water. The reservoirs are very low. So, climates yep. are changing.
Well, I mean, I feel like lawns are probably on the way out is what I think. I feel like they're probably going to be replaced by succulents or rocks mm-hmm. I feel like lawns are a thing of the past right now in certain areas, of course, not everywhere. But in California, there's a huge trade-off with trying to
yeah.
keep. There's actually some news that some people have been painting their lawns green. There are services that are now doing that, which sounds so crazy.
Putting
to me.
Succulents or cacti in their front. You see that in L.A. every now and then.
Yeah.
People changing
yeah,
their lawns.
Yeah.
And there was pushback from the people who don't like fracking. I was reading today that fracking used 70 million gallons of water in California.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the big businesses that's contributing to this is almond business. So almond milk actually needs a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an extremely inefficient way of processing these nutritious food products.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's actually a huge problem. So, if you want to help out a little bit, actually, it might be good to cut back on the almond milk.
Oh, well, almonds my favorite. Well, not the milk, but the almonds themselves. Are.
Oh, those you can still have.
Oh, is that
those
right?
Are still good.
It's the almond milk, not just the almond.
Crops are still actually very. They use a lot of water, mm-hmm. but almond milk really seems to be probably one of the worst things you can consume right now if you're in California.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about one last story you had that we didn't get to, and that was new drug resistant.
It's an intestinal bug. The bacteria that causes it is called Shigella. I'm not quite sure that I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But
Shigellosis.
Shigellosis yeah. is the intestinal the disease that comes from that, mm-hmm. the illness. It causes diarrhea. It can be bloody diarrhea sometimes. It causes fever. There's a lot of side effects from it. It usually goes away on its own, but when it's some of it is developing some resistance to common antibiotics. So that's been a problem recently.
Well, thank you very much for taking extra time.
Yeah, of course.
To be
thank
with
you.
Us here. Ariel Domrosa, science reporter at The Verge in New York. Yesterday, Iran agreed to an outline of a plan that would prevent it from developing nuclear weapons for at least 10 years. In exchange, the U.S. and five other world powers agreed to lift economic sanctions. And the framework calls for Iran to reduce the number of centrifuges it operates from 19,000 to about 6,000. It would be required to reduce its stockpile of enriched uranium from 10,000 kilograms to 300 kilograms. That's like a 97% reduction. So what calculus was used to come up with these numbers? What kinds of advanced technologies will ensure that Iran lives up to the agreements? These are kind of good questions for a nuclear physicist like my next guest, who's been sitting at the negotiating table. Ernest Moniz is Energy Secretary of the U.S. He's also served under the Clinton administration in the White House and the Department of Energy. He's a former professor of physics at MIT. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Moniz.
Thank you, Ira. It's good to be back.
You say in your statement that you released that I'm pleased to say that we are very confident in the technical underpinnings of this arrangement. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is, first of all, one of our guidelines, which I believe we have certainly observed, is that the so-called breakout time for Iran, if they chose to develop the material for nuclear bomb, will go up immediately from 2 or 2 to 3 months up to at least a year for at least 10 years. That is, we get there by doing some of the things you said, lowering the number of centrifuges, lowering their stockpile of uranium, but also by having very, very strong access and transparency measures so that we will feel extremely confident that if there is any violation of the agreement, we'll know it fast. And
how will you know? Do you have new high-tech eavesdropping or what kind of devices can you ensure? What's new in technology? How would you know if someone is cheating or not?
Well, first of all, the main thing is old-fashioned boots on the ground. So the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, will have essentially unfettered access. But in addition, they will be allowed to deploy their most modern technologies in terms of cameras, sensors, communication devices to have real-time observation.
So you'll have open access to all the nuclear facilities in Iran?
That's correct.
And how do you, let's talk about, get into the weeds a little bit, but how do you decide? I mentioned before that you talked about lowering the number of centrifuges down from like 20,000 to 6,000. How do you come up with a number that's not 595 or 7,500? What is the calculus that goes into that?
Yeah, mainly our DOE National Laboratory experts do models of how these uranium cascades work, and the input is the number of cascades, number of centrifuges, excuse me, and their capability, the arrangement of the centrifuges, the amount of uranium they have, and the enrichment that they start with. All of those go into a calculation, and this set of numbers, 300 kilograms, 3.7%, 5,000 centrifuges actually operating, and that comes out to this 1 year breakout period.
Mm-hmm. And you also, the framework says that Iran will be required to reduce its stockpile of enriched uranium from 10,000 kilograms to 300 kilograms. How do you pull those numbers out as what you aim for?
Well, that 300 kilograms, as I said, plus the enrichment of those kilograms, 3.67% to be exact, and the 5,060 operating centrifuges and an additional 1,000 or so that are standing around, those numbers all combined through our computer modeling into this one year requirement to reach enough high enriched uranium for a first weapon.
Mm-hmm. But how
should they go that way?
Should they go that way?
Right.
How are they going to get rid of that stockpile? Where does it go?
Well, there are fundamentally three options that they will need to pursue. One, which they've recently expressed less interest in, is to send it out of the country. For example, it could go to those who are fabricating their fuel for power reactors, like Russia in this case. It could be blended with low-enriched uranium, a very low-enriched uranium, that is, below natural uranium, in order to reach natural uranium, a dilution approach. And the third approach would be to market it on the international market for low-enriched uranium.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a personal relationship with your science counterpart on the Iranian negotiating team? Isn't that right? You and your counterpart, Ali Salehi, both graduated at the same time out of MIT?
Well, no, I was actually a young faculty member at MIT when he was a graduate student, although, to be honest, we never met at that time. We have met subsequently in Vienna at International Atomic Energy Agency meetings, but really, in terms of a serious professional relationship, it all developed over these last 5 weeks where we've probably spent 30 or 40 hours in one-on-one meetings. Hmm. So we've gotten to know each other quite well.
I'll bet. How would you judge the science level of Iran? Well, you've gotten to know the nuclear power people. How would you judge their science and their scientific level?
Well, certainly Mr. Salehi, for one, is obviously quite accomplished nuclear engineer. And I might say also in terms of the nature of our discussions, extremely professional and courteous and problem-solving oriented. Iran generally has a lot of young people who are going out of the country, studying elsewhere in advanced information and science and technology arenas. So they do have a well-trained cadre of young scientists and engineers. One of the parts of this agreement, by the way, would be to advance international collaboration on physics projects, for example, in what is currently their underground enrichment facility. That will be converted into a research facility involving international collaboration.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Eric Moniz, Energy Secretary of the United States. Do you see a collaboration, you know, a deeper collaboration between U.S. and Iranian scientists here that might open up greater dialogue with that country?
Well, you know, historically, as you know, in many cases, including with Russia during the Cold War, science-to-science collaboration in non-sensitive areas has been very, very important. It proved its worth later on in terms of our working together. I think it will be slow going. Clearly, there are lots of issues between the United States and Iran that go back 35 years, and will take a while to work out. But I think international collaboration going forward is in any event a good thing. And I hope, of course, that we will be able to reestablish relations in a way that our own collaborations are possible.
But do you see pushback from conservatives in Iran against this framework, as much as you're seeing pushback from conservatives in this country?
I think today there's no question about that. Again, part of this this is strictly a nuclear deal. It's aimed at the issue of assurances that Iran will not be pursuing a nuclear weapon, as they have claimed. And the idea here is it's going to take time. We will, if everything goes according to plan and according to their commitment against developing anything other than peaceful uses of nuclear energy, well, then confidence will build up over years. We've seen that actually in the last year and a half. The preliminary arrangement that we've had to give us time to negotiate has, in fact, been followed. Everyone agrees. Iran has followed those requirements to the letter, and that has helped build confidence in turn in this agreement. Mm. We still have a ways to go.
But you, as a scientific advisor on this and someone who sat in on the negotiations, and your team of scientists feel confident that you have the scientific prowess, the technical prowess to make this agreement stick if it goes ahead?
Yes, we feel that if all of the elements go forward, and of course they are agreed to in principle, they have to be worked out in terms of the detailed specifics for the full agreement. But with all of these implemented, we feel pretty confident, very confident, I should say, that we can have this breakout time.
And inspectors will be able to go to all the facilities, even the ones that were off limits before. And
all the nuclear facilities, but also as Iran implements what's called the additional protocol, and they will implement it immediately, even though it may take them a little bit longer to formally ratify it. With those, there will be access not only to declared, but also in case there's information that raises issues to undeclared facilities as well.
Do you think you'll be able to, you as a technologist, will be able to help bring the Israelis over to your side of the table?
Well, all I can say is we will present the technical underpinnings clearly. We think they are extremely solid. There are other issues that of course, are part of this agreement. And I should say, of course, Secretary Kerry, Department of State, of course, is the leader of our delegation, and he's been working at this for quite a while, actually, even when he was in the Senate. I've been engaged directly for the last 5 weeks. But I think there's no question that we can make a very, very solid case. Now, some cling to the idea that, well, there should not be any enrichment whatsoever. whatever. Well, that's a policy choice that was made some time ago. I personally believe that it would be unrealistic to imagine an agreement with Iran, and I believe we are far better off, as the president has said, with an agreement than without one. That's true for us. We believe it is true for our allies and friends as well.
Dr. Moniz, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Ira.
Ernest Moniz, Secretary, Energy Secretary of the U.S., talking about the interim plan that the United States and Iran have in the nuclear power industry. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about eggs. They used to call them the incredible edible eggs. They still do. And we have a secret way to hard boil eggs without boiling them. Yeah, stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've ever cooked hard-boiled eggs, and who hasn't, I'm sure this has happened to you. You boil up some eggs, you cook them, what, maybe 10, 12 minutes, get that perfect yolk, and then the fun part.
Peeling is such a pain, and what a mess. There has to be a better way to peel eggs without the hassle.
Well, guess what? There is, and it doesn't involve a gadget you buy on late-night TV. My next guest has tested dozens of eggs, including emu and ostrich eggs. You had to be there to find the best technique for cooking and peeling the perfect hard-boiled egg. And guess what? It doesn't involve boiling. It's our food failure series, and if you have an eggy dilemma, give us a call, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Jeff Potter is the author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. By day, a software engineer based here in New York. By evening, he's cooking up stuff in his kitchen. And we have his tricks for easy peel, hard cook eggs up on our website at sciencefriday.com/egg. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hey, Ira. Great to be back.
Let's get right into this. You have a whole bunch of stuff with you.
I do. So eggs...
Tell us the trick.
Eggs are complicated, yeah. Right? And the trick to hard cooked eggs is to steam them.
You steam them.
Steam them. Put a quarter inch of water in the bottom of your pan. Put your eggs in there and steam them for about 12 minutes. And the reason for this is that the water, when it converts to steam, ends up heating that egg much faster, making it that much easier to peel.
Hmm.
Now, most people think about hard boiling them to cook them, which, you know, doing right. boiling water does work. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that comes into play about making that egg easy to peel.
And it's the steam is the secret.
Well, steam is one secret. Now, this is one of the issues of writing food science stuff is it's always complicated. And what's supposed to work doesn't work. And, you know, you're talking about...
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, right. Well, that's my world, too. I mean, anytime you're writing about food science.
Right.
So with eggs, you know, something like the pH of the egg, which is actually related to how old mm-hmm. the egg is, there's a whole bunch of different things that come into play.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we have a little trip to the grocery store that Christopher Antaliata and you did to try to find the perfect egg.
I present to you Egg Row. Look at this. There's like three dozen different kinds of eggs.
And tell me what we're looking for today. We want to steam some eggs. So what does that mean?
One, we want the eggs to not be super fresh. So let's just pick up this pack right here. On the side, you see this two lines of printing. This one says... P1380, and then the next number, 079. And that's the number of days since January 1st that these eggs are actually picked from the coops. So if I were going to buy eggs here from hard peeling, I would probably, knowing what I know, basically kind of go for the cheapest pack that had an expiration date that, you know, hadn't passed, but was still... a little bit on the further side because, as I said, if we're going for hard cooking them, we want them to be a little more, shall we say, developed.
Mm. Mature.
Mature, yes, I like that. Mature eggs.
Mature eggs. A little... You go for the oldest egg.
Yeah, you want to go for older eggs because as the egg ages, carbon dioxide from the egg white actually leaves and changes the pH of the egg and makes it more alkaline.
Right.
So if you've got an egg, you know, when the chicken lays the egg, the chicken itself actually deposits that carbon dioxide into the egg white. And over time, you know, the egg's got something on the order of 7,000 to 17,000 little microscopic pores. You know, it's not a closed system. Air and gases are coming in and out.
Mm-hmm.
So that change in pH ends up being one part of the mystery of making an easy-to-peel egg. The other part is how you actually cook it. And then the third part is how you actually cool it down. So it's kind of a 1-2-3 here. The first step, make sure your eggs aren't super fresh. Second step, steam them. 12 minutes will do it. And the third step, well, a lot of people say you should shock your eggs in ice water. And that is a good thing to do, but it does not make them any easier to peel.
What? Wow.
So wow. I've got an egg here in my hand.
I see it.
And I'm going to try to crack this one. I cooked this just 2 hours ago in my kitchen.
Do I get
here.
To eat it at all? Or
you get to eat it. Now watch this. Like, it just literally falls out of the shell. I mean, that's just half a shell. Instantly done.
Two halves of the shell each.
Just
totally.
Pull off right like that. And that's because it was steamed. And now here's the bit I want you to see.
Yeah.
It's that the bottom of that egg actually is kind of flat. And that's because I did not cool it down super quickly. Now, if you'd actually drop this into just cold water, doesn't have to be ice water, you'll get a nice round bottom. So the shape of the egg is the reason that you would want it.
I was told that you prick the end,
you know,
that the air sac.
That actually matters for steaming, but this is something that has kind of gotten lost, and there's some telephone game that happens with how to cook in the kitchen. At some point, we lost the idea of steaming them, and when you steam them, putting a hole in the bottom, at least when I tested it, you know, makes a difference. Sometimes they crack, sometimes they don't. If you put a hole in the bottom, they don't crack.
All right, let's go to the phones. A lot of people want to talk eggs. 844-724-8255. Sue in Clinton, New York. Hi, Sue.
Hi, how are you?
Snow gone already?
Yes, just about.
Okay, tell what's on your mind?
Well, my husband keeps chickens in the backyard, just 6 of them, and I find it very difficult to hard-boil a fresh egg and peel it.
That would be
it's not easy to peel.
That would be because those eggs, when they're fresh, have a pH that's lower. And the researchers find that the pH needs to be about 9.2. So it's that same carbon dioxide thing I was talking about. What you should do is leave them in your fridge for about 4 or 5 days. And over the course of those days, the carbon dioxide from the egg white will actually drift out of the egg, change the pH, and that will change how the outer edge of the egg white adheres to the inner membrane of the eggshell.
So do you keep your eggs in the fridge, or do you leave them out?
We keep them in the fridge.
That's a really good point. When it comes to eggs, the other issue that comes up all the time, of course, is salmonella. And in this country, we do wash the eggs, and there's this idea that washing the eggs done commercially is what damages the cuticle and actually causes salmonella to be potentially present into the egg. And that is true. It does happen. But the reality is that most egg salmonella infections actually occur from the chicken when the chicken is laying the egg before the shell is actually formed around it. So salmonella and eggs, you know, it's always wise to keep them fridged because you never know.
Hmm. Good luck, Sue, with your eggs.
Thanks so much. So 4 to 5 days, that's the magic number.
That should do it. And if it doesn't, you know, I would be curious to hear more from you why.
Should she wash her egg, or should she just...
She doesn't need to wash the egg. Actually, there is some stuff about washing eggs in cold water where the water can actually draw in because there's a temperature change. So if you have contaminants in the environment, washing them with the temperature change can draw stuff into that shell.
So if I were you, and I'm not, I wish, you know, I would have sunny side ups with a fresh egg like that.
There is nothing like a fresh egg, right?
Yeah, I don't. Well, like, you get too many of them, Sue. So you're spoiled. You want a hard boil.
I was lucky to grow
up. Thanks, Sue, for calling. Have a good holiday. Yeah,
I was lucky to grow up, actually. Yeah. My mom had a couple of chickens that we had, and there's nothing like watching a chicken lay an egg and going and frying it. It's just, you can't get that at the grocery store.
If she's got them in her backyard, they're probably free-ranging out there. And everything. Oh, I know.
How do I get some of those eggs?
So what about any other egg mythology that we should know about?
Egg mythologies. That's an excellent question. Sorry, I couldn't help eggs lend themselves.
That is quite all right. Now, people are going to be using eggs in their recipes this weekend.
Right. So there's a couple of egg myths, egg thoughts. You know, does color of the shell matter?
Right.
Does how the chicken's fed, all the different labels and claims. So there's also, hey, you're cooking eggs and you're going to dye them. By the way, if you're dyeing your eggs, you can just use vinegar and some food dye. You don't need to buy the tablets. If you are cooking them and then, you know, going to hide them in the yard for kids to find, the recommendation is to not eat those eggs, just because you never know what soil contaminant, you know, might drift into the egg. But yeah, tons of different things you can.
Well, let me give you a recipe. Certain recipes for like tiramisu or eggnog use raw eggs to get that creamy texture. But, you know, people don't want to use. That makes people squeamish. Yeah. You know, is there a way to boost the safety of an egg without actually cooking it?
You can actually pasteurize an egg. In your grocery store, if you look for it, you might find them. When it comes to pasteurization, that's about reducing the salmonella that might be present, which is different from cooking the proteins in that egg. So you can actually take an egg up to temperature, and I want to say it's like 137 degrees Fahrenheit for 4 minutes. It's something like that. Not something you should try at home unless you've got great lab equipment. But you can pasteurize an egg. So if you are concerned about that, you could certainly use pasteurized eggs. Me personally, as a healthy guy, not being older, younger, immunocompromised, and I'm obviously not pregnant, the idea of salmonella, I'm not super concerned for me personally. Right. Chances are low.
Let's go to Betsy in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hi, Betsy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hey there.
Thank you for taking my question. I'm sitting here poised over a bowl, and I have an egg question that has nothing to do with, well, it does have something to do with Easter. I'm making meringues, which requires egg whites, and I'm making a lot of them for a big crowd. And so I looked in the fridge, and I thought, why don't I use this carton of egg whites? It's a lot easier than separating 12 eggs. Mm. But when I called the 800 number to find out how to measure it, they said it wouldn't make very good meringues. And because it's pasteurized, and I'm wondering if that's true, number one, if I should throw out this bowl of egg whites, and number two, why that is.
It is true. The whites won't foam up to as large of a volume. This is the same reason why you're admonished to never get any egg yolk into your egg whites. It turns out you actually can get a little bit of oil. It'll still whisk up, just not to the same volume. There's something about the pasteurization process changes the structures of those proteins such that they don't quite whisk up to the same volume. In terms of your quandary, you know, not wanting to crack a dozen eggs, you could always try it and see what happens. You might find that even though the volume is not as high as you would want it to be for other applications, that in what you're doing, it might be perfectly fine to have it not expand to the full potential that an ideal egg white would do.
Yeah, good luck to you.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Here's a tweet that came in from John Webb. He says, I microwave 2 eggs in the morning, fast and easy, but stinky. Any way to eliminate the stink cooking that way?
Oof.
Is it stinky or is it baby?
Yeah, that stink's coming from sulfur. There's sulfur in the egg white, and that's actually the same thing that causes a discoloration of color on the egg yolk when you hard cook them. That sulfur is going to come out. I think probably your best bet is to open the window. Not the advice you're looking for.
The low-tech solution.
The low-tech solution is pragmatic, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a good way with microwave. That's a good one. I haven't heard it before. But I would imagine not, because that sulfur coming out has to do with it being dissolved in the white, and how quickly you heat things up is going to change how that sulfur converts to hydrogen sulfide and basically dissolves out of solution into gas.
Another tweet from Matteo says, can you do the 5-minute egg using the steaming method as well? How does it scale?
The 5-minute egg.
Is that like soft boiled?
Yeah, I'm assuming that's a soft boil, because at 5 minutes it's steaming, you're not going to get a hard cooked egg. It's just a question of time and temperature. If you wanted to cook a hard cooked egg in 5 minutes, that would be a good question. You'd have to hit it with a lot more heat. So you couldn't do that with steam. But yeah, there's no reason why, you know, the proteins don't know that they're being heated up only so much. I mean, there's dozens of different proteins in eggs. They all start to denature and cook at different temperatures. So sure, a 5-minute egg via steam, you know, you might have to play the time.
Yeah.
The energy transfer might be different.
Right. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about eggs with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. It is so popular in our office, I can't grab a copy away from anybody. Let's go to the phones. Yeah, our number 844-724-8255. Let's go to Laurie. Laurie in Rocky Valley, Iowa? Rock Valley?
Hi, yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I have a question about hard-boiling fresh eggs, too. It's a little different. I'm having a hard time with my fresh eggs, even when they're like almost a week old, centering the yolks for deviled eggs. When I have hard-boiled eggs from the store, it's not a problem. They center fine. But when they're fresh from the farm, the yolks are so tied up against the shell quite often that when I peel them, the yolk is exposed and gets waterlogged. Mm. And then you don't get that nice center when you do the deviled egg.
My understanding of this one is that you need to actually rotate your eggs when you store them. So when you say that they're fresh from the farm, are you talking about literally you went out and you picked the egg up and you went straight to the kitchen and hard cooked it?
I've got connections, so my eggs are fresh when they come to me.
Aha.
But I get like three to five dozen at a time.
Wow.
I would love that connection.
I know, it's pretty sweet.
I would say try flipping them over and rotating them, because the yolk itself, you know, it's going to be heavier than that white, and it's basically essentially sinking. There's a part of the egg called, and I never pronounce it right, the chalazi, which holds that yolk kind of in suspension in the center. And if there's something going on, I'm assuming that hasn't been twisted up and snapped off internally inside your egg, in which case, flip your eggs over. You know, try rotating them every day. Just if you've got the container sitting on one side, just rotate 180 degrees and see what happens.
Well, Lori, thanks a lot.
Perfect.
And have
I'll
a good,
that. Thank
have
you.
A good weekend. Thanks for calling. We've run out of time. Anything that you need to know about, that you'd like to know about eggs that you don't know yet?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, Jesus. Right?
Yeah.
You could teach an entire course on eggs. And I mean, you could teach science stuff just using eggs for years. Like, they're complicated.
I'll bet. Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. You're also a software engineer working on some good software.
I'm working on some stuff with the Global Literacy Project, using tablets, teaching kids how to read, actually.
Well, that's terrific. We'll talk about that someday.
I'd like that.
We actually have a bonus extravaganza on our website. Julie Liebeck has put the picture of the week up there of the horn shark egg case. And you're not going to find this egg on your grocer's shelf or rolling in an egg hunt. It's really crazy. It's sciencefriday.com/sharkegg. One last thing before we go. You've seen it so many times on your laptop and your cell phone, but can you draw the Apple logo? No cheating. You can't look at your, you know, laptop lid right now. And this is not a rhetorical question. If you're near a pen and paper, I want you to actually try to go and draw it. And if you're struggling trying to remember, does that little leaf point left or right, you're not alone. UCLA psychology professor Alan Castell and his team asked 85 undergraduates to draw that famous logo, and you know how many got right? One.
We saw a lot of things that resembled apples, but a lot of the features were incorrect. We'd find a leaf that was pointing straight up, or sometimes a stem, or two leaves. The takeaway, I think, is that memory is not just a function of how often we've seen something. Just because we've seen something many times doesn't mean we'll remember it.
In fact, Castell says that it could be the more we see something, the more we stop really seeing it. And if you're playing along at home wondering what the Apple logo really looks like?
I still get this wrong, but the bite is on the right side. The leaf points at an angle to the right, and there's a small dimple in the bottom of the apple.
There you go. Now you will never forget it. There you go. Now you will never forget it. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin, our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners at the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, point your tablet to or your smartphone to our website, sciencefriday.com. And please join our mailing list. And if you like us, then like us on Facebook, where we're there all week long. And you can tweet us at SciFry and download our iPhone and Android apps and listen to individual segments there by using our app. Have a great weekend. If you're celebrating Easter, have a happy Passover and a happy Easter. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.